When it was time for the midday meal, Memnon strung his bow and killed 5 of these antelope with as many arrows. We skinned and butchered the carcasses as their fellows streamed by us at arm's length. Despite the animal's strange appearance, their flesh, when grilled on the coals of an open fire, was as good to eat as any wild game I had tasted. "This is another gift from the gods," Memnon declared. "As soon as we rejoin the main army, we will send out an expedition to follow these herds. We will be able to smoke enough meat to feed all our armies and our slaves from now until these beasts come again next year." From our Shilluk guides we learned that this incredible migration was an annual occurrence, as the herds moved from one grazing ground to another, several hundred miles apart. The Shilluk called these beasts Gnu, in imitation of their strange honking cry. "This will be a never-ending supply, one that is replenished each year," I informed the prince. None of us was then able to foresee the catastrophic events which would flow from this visitation of the ungainly Gnu. I might have been warned by the manner in which they threw up their heads and snorted without reason, or by the discharge of mucus from the nostrils of some of these beasts that I noticed as they streamed past us. However, I gave little thought to this behaviour and judged them to be mild and harmless creatures who could bring us nothing but great benefit. As soon as we reached the Twin Rivers, we reported the migration of Gnu to Queen Lostris, and she agreed with Prince Memnon's suggestion. Assisted by Kratos and Remren, she put him in command of a column of 200 chariots, supported by wagons and several thousand Shilluk. She ordered him to slaughter as many Gnu as could be cut up and smoked for army rations. I did not accompany the expedition, for the role of butcher's assistant was not to my fancy. However, we could soon see the smoke from the fires on which the meat was curing, darkening the horizon, and before many more days had passed, the wagons started to return, each one loaded high with blackened slabs of cured meat. Exactly 20 days from our first encounter with the Gnu herds, I was sitting under a shady tree on the bank of the Nile, playing bao with my old and dear friend Aten. As a small indulgence to myself and out of deference to Aten, I had opened one of the precious jars of 3-palm quality wine that remained from the stock which I had brought from Egypt. Aten and I played and haggled as old friends do, and sipped the wine with deep appreciation. We had no means of knowing that catastrophe was rushing down upon us to overwhelm us all. On the contrary, I had every reason to be pleased with myself. The previous day I had completed the drawings and plans for the building of Pharaoh's tomb, in which I had incorporated several features to deter and frustrate the depredations of any grave robber. Queen Lostris had approved these plans and appointed one of the master masons as the overseer. She told me that I might requisition all the slaves and equipment that I needed. My mistress was determined that she would not stint in making good her vow to her dead husband. She would build him the finest tomb that my genius could design. I had just won the 3rd successive board of bao from Aten, and was pouring another jar of the truly excellent wine when I heard the beat of hooves and looked up to see a horseman coming at full gallop from the direction of the chariot lines. When he was still at a distance, I recognised Tui. Very few others rode astride, and certainly not at such a headlong pace. As he raced towards where we sat, I saw the expression on his face, and it alarmed me so that I stood up abruptly enough to spill the wine and upset the bao board. "Tighter!" he screamed at me from 100 yards. "The horses! Sweet Isis, have mercy on us, the horses!" He reined down his mount, and I swung up behind him and seized him around the waist. "Don't waste time talking," I shouted in his ear. "Ride, fellow, ride!" I went to Patience first. Half the herd was down, but she was my first love. The mare lay upon her side with her chest heaving. She was old now, with grey hairs frosting her muzzle. I had not used her in the traces since the day that Blade had been killed by the elephant bull. Although she no longer pulled a chariot, she was the finest brood mare in all our herds. Her foals all inherited her great heart and vivid intelligence. She had just weaned a beautiful little colt who stood near her now, watching her anxiously. I knelt beside her. "What is it, my brave darling?" I asked softly, and she recognized my voice and opened her eyes. The lids were gummed with mucus. I was appalled by her condition. Her neck and throat were swollen to almost twice their normal girth. A vile-smelling stream of yellow pus streamed from her mouth and nostrils. The fever was burning her up, so that I could feel the heat radiate from her as though from a campfire. She tried to rise when I stroked her neck, but she was too weak. She fell back, and her breath gurgled and wheezed in her throat. The thick, creamy pus bubbled out of her nostrils, and I could hear that she was drowning in it. Her throat was closing, so that she had to do battle for each breath. She was watching me with an almost human expression of trust and appeal. I was overcome with a sense of helplessness. This affliction was beyond my previous experience. I slipped the snowy white linen shawl from my shoulder and used it to mop the streaming pus from her nostrils. It was a pathetically inadequate attempt, for as fast as I wiped it away, fresh trickles of the stinking stuff poured from her. "Taita!" Huey called to me. "Every one of our animals has been stricken by this pestilence." Grateful for the distraction, I left patience and went through the rest of the herd. Half of them were down already, and those still upright were mostly staggering or beginning to drool the thick yellow pus from their mouths. "What must we do?" Huey and all the charioteers appealed to me. I was burdened with their trust. They expected me alone to avert this terrible disaster, and I knew that it was beyond my powers. I knew of no remedy, and I could not think of even the most drastic and unlikely treatment. I stumbled back to where Patience lay, and wiped away the latest flood of stinking discharge from her muzzle. I could see that she was sinking away swiftly. Each breath she drew now was a terrible struggle. My grief weakened me, and I knew that in my helplessness I would soon melt into tears and be of no further use to any of them, neither horses nor men. Somebody knelt beside me, and I looked up to see that it was one of the Shilluk grooms, a willing and likely fellow whom I had befriended, and who now looked upon me as his master. "It is the sickness of the Gnu," he told me in his simple language. "Many will die." I stared at him, as what he said began to make sense in my muddled mind. I remembered the snorting, drooling herds of slate-coloured animals, darkening the plains with their numbers, and how we had thought it a gift of the benevolent gods. "This sickness kills our cattle when the Gnu come. Those that live through it are safe. They are never sick again." "What can we do to save them, Habani?" I demanded. But he shook his head. "There is nothing to be done." I was holding Patience's head in my arms when she died. The breath choked away in her throat, and she shuddered, and her legs stiffened and then relaxed. I let out a low moan of grief, and was on the very edge of the abyss of despair when I looked up and through my tears saw that Patience's colt was down, with the yellow slime bubbling up from his throat. In that moment my despair was replaced with a burning anger. "No!" I shouted. "I will not let you die also." I ran to the foal's side and shouted to Habani to bring leather buckets of hot water. With a linen cloth I bathed the colt's throat in an attempt to reduce the swelling, but it had no effect. The pus still poured from his nostrils, and the hot skin of his neck stretched out as the flesh ballooned like a bladder filling with air. "He is dying," Habani shook his head. "Many will die." "I will not let it happen," I swore grimly, and sent Hui to the galley to fetch my medicine chest. By the time he returned, it was almost too late. The colt was in extremis. His breath was choking out of him, and I could feel his strength draining away under my frantic hands. I felt for the ridged rings of his windpipe at the juncture of his throat and his chest. With one shallow cut through the skin, I exposed the white sinewy pipe, and then I pressed the point of my scalpel into it and pierced the tough sheath. Immediately air hissed through the aperture, and I saw the colt's chest swell as his lungs inflated. He began to breathe again, to a steady and even rhythm, but I saw almost immediately that the puncture wound in his throat was closing again with blood and mucus. In frantic haste, I hacked a length of bamboo from the framework of the nearest chariot, and I cut a hollow tube from the end of it and pushed this into the wound. The bamboo tube held the wound open, and the colt relaxed his struggles as the air sucked and blew unimpeded through it. "Huey!" I yelled for him. "I will show you how to save them." Before night fell, I had trained 100 or more of the charioteers and grooms to perform this crude but effective surgery, and we worked on through the night by the wavering, uncertain light of the oil lamps. There were over 13,000 horses in the royal herds by this time, and we could not save them all, although we tried. We worked on, with the blood from the severed throats caked black up to our elbows. When exhaustion overcame us, we fell on a bale of hay and slept for an hour and then staggered up and went back to work. Some of the horses were not as badly affected by this pestilence, which I had named the Yellow Strangler. They seemed to have an inborn resistance to its ravages. The discharge from their nostrils was no more copious than I had seen in the gnu herds, and many of these remained on their feet and threw off the disease within days. Many others died before we were able to open the windpipe, and even some of those on which we had successfully operated died later from mortification and complication of the wound which we had inflicted. Of course, many of our horses were out on expeditions into the plains and beyond my help. Prince Memnon lost 2 out of every 3 of his steeds and had to abandon his chariots and return to the Quebui rivers on foot. In the end, we lost over 1/2 our horses, 7,000 dead, and those that survived were so weakened and cast down that it was many months before they were strong and fit enough to pull a chariot. Patience's colt survived and replaced his old dam in my affections. He took the right-hand trace in my chariot and was so strong and reliable that I called him Rock. "How has this pestilence affected our hopes of a swift return to Egypt?" my mistress asked me. "It has set us back many years," I told her, and saw the pain in her eyes. "We lost most of our best-trained old horses, those like Patience. We will have to breed up the royal herds all over again, and train young horses to take their places in the traces of the chariots." I waited for the annual migration of the gnu the following year with dread, but when it came and their multitudes once more darkened the plains, Habana was proved correct. Only a few of our horses developed the symptoms of the Yellow Strangler, and these in a mild form that set them back for only a few weeks before they were strong enough to work again. What struck me as strange was that the foals born in the period after the first infection of the Yellow Strangler, those who had never been exposed to the actual disease, were as immune as their dams who had contracted a full dose. It was as though the immunity had been transferred to them in the milk that they sucked from their mother's udder. I was certain that we would never again have to experience the full force of the plague. My major duty now, laid upon me by my mistress, was the construction of Pharaoh's tomb in the mountains. I was obliged to spend much of my time in that wild and forbidding place, and I became fascinated by those mountains and all their moods. Like a beautiful woman, the mountains were unpredictable, sometimes remote and hidden in dense moving veils of clouds that were shot through with lightning and riven with thunder. At other times they were lovely and seductive, beckoning to me, challenging me to discover all their secrets and experience all their dangerous delights. Although I had 8,000 slaves to prosecute the task, and the unstinted assistance of all our finest craftsmen and artists, the work on the tomb went slowly. I knew it would take many years to complete the elaborate mausoleum which my mistress insisted we must build, and to decorate it in a fashion fit for the Lord of the Two Kingdoms. In truth, there was no point in hurrying the work, for it would take as long to rebuild the royal horse herds and train the Shilluk infantry regiments until they were a match for the Hyksos squadrons, against which they would one day be matched. When I was not up in the mountains working at the tomb, I spent my time at Quebui, where there were a myriad different tasks and pleasures awaiting me. These ranged from the education of my 2 little princesses to devising new military tactics with Lord Tanus and the prince. By this time it was clear that whereas Memnon would one day command all the chariot divisions, Tanus had never outgrown his first distrust of the horse. He was a sailor and an infantryman to the bone, and as he grew older, he was ever more conservative and traditional in his use of his new Shilluk regiments. The prince was growing into a dashing and innovative charioteer. Each day he came to me with 12 new ideas, some of them far-fetched, but others quite brilliant. We tried them all, even the ones that I knew were impossible. He was 16 years old when Queen Lostris promoted him to the rank of best of 10,000. Now that Tanus rode with me so seldom, I slowly took over the role of Memnon's principal driver. We developed a rapport which became almost instinctive and which extended to our favourite team of horses, Rock and Chain. When we were on the march, Memnon still liked to drive, and I stood on the footplate behind him. However, as soon as we engaged in action, he would toss me the reins and seize his bow or his javelins from the rack. I would take the chariot into the fray and steer it through the evolutions we had dreamed up together. As Memnon matured and his strength increased, we began to win some of the prizes at the games and the military tattoos that were a feature of our lives at Kwibui. First, we triumphed in the flat races, where our team of rock and chain could display its paces to the full. Then we began to win the shooting and javelin contests. Soon we were known as the chariot that had to be beaten before anyone could claim the champion's ribbon from Queen Lostries. I remember the cheers as our chariot flew through the final gate of the course, myself at the traces, and Memnon on the footplate hurling a javelin right and left into the two straw-filled dummies as we passed. Then the mad dash down the straight, with the prince howling like a demon, and the long wind-blown plait of his hair standing out behind his head, like the tail of a charging lion.